From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Cynthia Barnett says, among other things, rain is a love story. If you look at the arc of human civilization, you see all the elements, she says, excitement, longing, heartbreak. In her latest book, Barnett explores the science and cultural history of rain, how it gave this planet its identity, how it shaped human evolution, how we worshipped it, used it to inspire art, and how we've always been determined to master rain. We never have, by the way, but as we've made the planet warmer, we have managed to change rain. Today in the program, Barnett is joining us to explain how rain is not only a part of our chaotic atmosphere, but part of our chaotic selves, and how that complicated relationship can actually bind us together. Rain, after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Cynthia Barnett says all human cultures so far have tried to master rain. We tried worshiping it, praying about it. We've burned witches to stop it, sacrificed children to bring it. And think about irrigation and cloud seeding and Doppler radar and mega computer modeling. And still, there's a mystery about rain that today's meteorologists share with the earliest observers. In her book, Barnett says everyone loves to talk about the rain, with the forecast and the clouds you probably already have this morning. And she says rain is a conversation that we share, an opening to connect. And that's the surprising part about her book, that rain has the potential to bring us together, because it certainly has in the past. The book is also about the science of rain, the strangeness of rain, and the culture we've built up around it. Cynthia Barnett is joining us today to talk about the book. It's called Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. Cynthia Barnett is an environmental journalist. She teaches at the University of Florida in Gainesville. She's the author of a number of other books on water, including Blue Revolution. And she's joining us today from NPR member station WUFT in Gainesville. And Cynthia Barnett, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Thanks very much for having me on.
Well, explain what it is that got you thinking about rain. Because you've mentioned that as you were traveling around the country, talking about the books that you've written about water, it seems like everyone wanted to talk about rain.
Yeah, so that's part of the answer. I mean, a big part of the answer has to be that I absolutely love rain. I'm a Floridian, as you mentioned. I grew up with really dramatic thunderstorms and beautiful rains, and I find rain inspirational. But you're right, I've written two other water books, and as I went around the country talking about my book Blue Revolution, which is about the idea of a water ethic for the nation, and I would try to talk about climate change, right? And I found that even people who didn't want to talk about climate change or who deny climate change, they still love to talk about the weather. They wanted to talk about the epic drought or the, you know, more extreme hurricanes or the more extreme precipitation that we're seeing. And so really came to see weather and rain as a unifying force in a very fractured conversation. And I think it is a way that can bring people together to talk about the climate.
You say the idea for the book finally came to you on a drizzly Friday afternoon? Tell me that day.
Yeah, it was. It was in October, and I've got French doors outside my study where I write, and it hit me, you know, thinking about people's love for talking about the weather and how often I end up talking about the weather, that, oh my gosh, it would be so much fun to write the biography of rain. But then I immediately thought, surely someone's done this, right? If they've done cod and salt and clouds,
right.
they've definitely done the rain. And I was amazed that no one had done it before. And but I really didn't want to write a wonky or a prescriptive book about rain.
Yeah.
I wrote for many years about water policy as an environmental journalist, and I can explain, you know, water pricing and pollution and all sorts of things like that. But I found myself often writing for the environmental choir, and I didn't want to do that this time. I wanted to try to write a book that could appeal to more readers, and to this kind of large readership I think of as the caring middle.
Yeah.
These are people who would care about the environmental issues. They may not seek out water and environmental news, but they do care once they understand. And so that's why I wanted to tap the poetry and the songs, you know, not just the science of rain, but the culture of rain that's been so important to humanity. And once I started unfurling some of those strings, I just became really obsessed with the topic and had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah. You write in the book that we are bound in the memory and mystery of rain. And it seems like that word bound is an important one to you. I mean, you've already mentioned this idea of how rain seems to bring people together in drought and in flood and all of those other things. This isn't just the one theme, because I think there's another one, this idea of control, but this
yes.
idea of being bound and being unified by rain, that seems important to you?
It's absolutely an important theme. I didn't realize how important when I started working on this, but when you look at our earliest evolution out of East Africa millions of years ago, we had to stand up and leave the rainforest when that environment began turning arid.
Yeah.
And then later, when we see the rise of the first civilizations along in Mesopotamia and the Indus Valley and along the Yellow River, these civilizations all started around rivers when we entered more arid times, and people had to come together to figure out irrigation and feeding one another. So absolutely, rain or lack of rain has been a really cohesive force for all of human history.
We'll come back to this idea of how rain has influenced human evolution, because that it's kind of fun to talk about.
It's fun, yeah.
Let's start with the earth and water, because in the book you kind of come back around to this at the end, which we'll get to, this idea that climate change may bring us kind of full circle, but it really was rain, I mean, the first rains that gave Earth its identity as a blue planet. It's the thing that distinguished us from, like, Mars and Venus. Let's start there.
Yeah, that's right. So I really wanted to start with the first rains. You know, we've heard about the first rains since childhood, and imagine how epic they must have been. So I interviewed astrobiologists to try to get a feeling for, you know, what it might have looked like and what it might have felt like. But the really interesting thing they told me was that, you know, you've got to remember that Earth, Mars, and Venus were sort of all born of the same batch of flying fireballs. They all boasted the same remarkable feature, and that was water. So what made us exceptional from Mars and Venus was not so much that we had water, because all the so-called terrestrial planets had it.
Yeah.
It's that Earth held on to its water and evolved this, you know, incredibly beautiful atmospheric cycle that we know now. It, you know, we had the rains, we had the atmosphere that kept the water on Earth, kept it falling, kept it in this ideal cycle that filled the aquifers and the rivers and the seas. And really, it's that atmosphere and that rain that set us apart. Perhaps not so much the water. And that's not something I had thought about before. And I really, you know, that idea fascinated
yeah.
me, that it was rain that was quite, quite exceptional.
Well, this is also an important point, because we'll come back to it. But this idea of water vapor,
yes,
which you describe as the invisible redeemer, and we should explain, water vapor is a heat-trapping gas. I'm not sure I had thought about it in those terms either.
Yeah, so today, at any moment, more water rushes through the atmosphere than flows through all the world's rivers combined. This book has changed my thinking about the way I look at water. I had often looked at it in its, you know, I tried to look at it in its natural places, in its rivers and in its aquifers. Some people too much look at it in its pipes and its canals, right?
Yeah.
But there's a bigger picture way to look at it, and that is in a field instead of in a line, and that's all the water in the atmosphere as well. So yes, I describe water vapor as the invisible redeemer, that process that brought us the rains. And as you point out, water vapor is a heat-trapping gas. It's a greenhouse gas, just like carbon dioxide, but of course, the human caused climate change is being caused by our pumping more carbon dioxide into the air. So that is something we can control, unlike the amount of water vapor in the air.
Yeah, you know, do we have a sense of what the first rains may have been like when it was finally cool enough for the rain to actually get to the surface of the earth? And I was intrigued by this footnote in the book that says scientists have actually discovered impressions of the oldest fossilized raindrops, like in South Africa or something.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. So I wanted to get at exactly the question you're asking. I talked to, you know, some of the leading astrobiologists in the world and asked them if they could describe the first rains and or imagine the first rains. And it turns out that the early period, the Hadean period that we're talking about, was so violent that there really isn't a geological record existing from that time. And so it was really interesting to talk to some of these scientists about what they imagined it was like. And they can certainly imagine it. And one fellow I interviewed had worked in southern Louisiana, and he said some days he would think of the first rains as those terrific rains of southern Louisiana where you just can't even see your hand in front of you, and you've got to pull the car over to the side of the road, and the rains on the car roof sound like a steel drum. That's what he imagined they might have been like. But the truth is that scientists don't know exactly what the first rains looked like or how long they poured. So that's why the prologue is a bit imaginative.
Yeah.
And I actually used Ray Bradbury to talk about planetary rains, because, again, I didn't want it to be dry.
No.
And I wanted to tap literary figures who were inspired by rain to help explain some of these ideas.
Well, and it's throughout, and we'll get to a lot of them. Ray Bradbury, of course, who writes about rain in the Martian Chronicles and in The Long Rain. I mean, you say that Bradbury just loved rain.
He did. He loved rain. He never wrote a novel without rain in it, and he wrote a beautiful short story. My favorite rain story is his story, The Long Rain,
yeah,
in which rain really is a character. You might have seen Rod Steiger play the space captain in The Illustrated Man, who lands on a Venus just sopping in rain, and the rain ends up driving him and his rocket ship mates mad.
Crazy.
But Bradbury describes rain. It was a hard rain, a perpetual rain, a sweating and steaming rain. It was a mizzle, a downpour, a fountain, a whipping at the eyes, an undertow at the ankles. It was a rain to drown all rains and the memory of rain. One of my favorite rain lines.
There's a whole section where you write about, and maybe this is a good time to bring Emily Dickinson into the picture, and Morrissey for that matter, and
Kurt Cobain.
Kurt Cobain, of course. Yeah. This idea, because there are a lot of misconceptions sort of surrounding it. On one hand, there's this idea that rain is dreary and depressing, and in many ways it's probably true, but you also talk about the fact that that rain has been, that's been a marker for the most productive we've been as civilization, and also it's inspired people. I mean, Dickinson, you mentioned that her best poems, maybe not her, not the most poems, but her best poems were written in times of crummy weather.
That's true. Let me take one step back to the point you were making about rain as dull and dreary. I make the case that rain is actually the great colorant of Earth, right? Because even the sky, if you ever see a really, and you've got these skies in Utah, a brilliant, brilliant blue sky is often the result of a rain the day before, because as you know, especially over Salt Lake City, you have those days where gritty bits really build up in the atmosphere, and then you have a beautiful rain and it just washes the sky blue. It's that case with the sky, it's that case with the hills. You know, if the more rain we have in the spring, the brighter the wildflowers. The more rain we have in the summer, the more brilliant the fall foliage the following autumn. And so I think rain does have a rather undeserved reputation for making the world dull and gray, but it is very true that some people are depressed by rain. Some people are depressed by poor weather, seasonal affective disorder. And Emily,
wait, before you get there, because I do want to, this is something that I found so intriguing about this idea of rain being the great brightener.
Yes, yes.
I'm like trying to imagine now the Ice Age, which didn't have a lot of rain, obviously. So one thing that you mentioned is that the Ice Age, when you're trying to conceive of what it was like, okay, it's probably really cold, but it was also really dusty.
It was terribly dusty. I found that absolutely fascinating, because we think of the Ice Age, you know, in the picture we have in our mind's eye of the Ice Age, which I think comes from lots of children's cartoons and television shows. Yeah. But the skies of the Ice Age must have been terribly gritty. I mean, scientists, the thing that really they find all over the world in that age is a very, very high level of dust compared to the way we live now. Things are much brighter, and so it must have been an extraordinarily bleak time with very, you know, grayish or yellowish skies.
And I guess in some ways that's kind of how it works. I mean, a drop of rain is the water, is the, there has to be some, I mean, for it to rain, the drop has to cling to something, and often it is a particle of dust, right? Or a particle of bacteria.
Right. That's right. Rain needs a little bit of something to cling to. That's how a raindrop forms. And so you need a little bit of something in the atmosphere, but you know, and I've never seen this as strongly as I've seen it in Salt Lake City. When I was last there, the sky was quite dense and bleak, the way it becomes sometimes when it hasn't rained in a long time. And then there was a rainstorm on my last day, and it really cleaned, you know, it cleaned the sky in such a stark way. It's the starkest way I've ever seen rain scrub a place. And I thought that was just amazing. I'm sure you guys look forward to the rain when you've got those smoggy days.
No doubt about it. Which brings us to another, I have to say, kind of fun fact about the shape of a raindrop, which we misperceive. It doesn't look like we think it looks in a cartoon.
That's right. Yeah, so another theme is the great misperceptions we have about rain. And I think one of them is color. I think one of them is just the way we've built our cities against rain, which we can talk about later. But maybe also the most basic picture we have of rain and the way we draw a raindrop, whether you're 4 years old or 40, is a drop as if a drop from the faucet with a pointed top and a fat, rounded bottom. In reality, that image is upside down. Raindrops actually fall in the shape of tiny parachutes or hamburger buns, so their top is rounded by air pressure from below.
We need to take a break, so let's do that before we talk about inspiration and Emily Dickinson, because I do absolutely want to get back to that. Cynthia Barnett is with us. Her book called Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KEWR. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the environmental journalist Cynthia Barnett is with us to talk about the science and the cultural history of rain. In her new book, Barnett explains that throughout human history, we've worshipped rain and prayed for rain. And this is a story of us trying to get control of the rain, which we've never really done. But with climate change, as we'll get to, we have managed to change rain. Her book is called Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. All right, so tell us of going to Aberdeen, Washington. This is where Kurt Cobain, of course, grew up, and that was such a profound influence on the grunge scene, on his work, not to mention what happened in Manchester with Morrissey and the Smiths. The rain and its influence on music.
So I actually had this idea when I was in Cherrapunji, India, which is the rainiest place on Earth, and I happened to be there at the same time a BBC crew was there, and one of the BBC journalists was from Manchester, England, and so we were talking about the fact that both the United States and the United Kingdom have rain capitals that are not really rain capitals. So the United States has Seattle, it's, you know, so-called City of Rain. The UK also has a City of Rain in Manchester, but neither of those cities is actually the rainiest place in the country. They just have that moniker because they have a lot of cloud cover. So they're both really drizzly cities. But what evolved out of this conversation, I was talking about the music that had come out of Seattle, and she was talking about the music that had come out of Manchester, and we sort of put together that America's City of Rain, rain birthed grunge in the same way that Manchester's City of Rain had birthed its angst-filled independent rock genres, right? So Morrissey's band, The Smiths, Joy Division, New Order, and others, these really moody indie pop bands. And so I decided to look into rain as a spark of creativity. So both Kurt Cobain and Morrissey absolutely hated their gloomy hometowns. Yeah, they wrote a lot about their hometowns, talked a lot about their hometowns. Morrissey described him as Victorian life knife plunging Manchester.
Right.
And Cobain also hated his hometown of Aberdeen, Washington. So I traveled to both places, but I have to say that in the end, I didn't try to ascribe the rise of grunge to the rain by any means. I thought that would be a stretch on my part as a journalist trying to write about rain, but I did, I think it's clear that rain captures a mood and it can inspire a song. But I think it would be a real stretch to try to, ascribe Cobain's, suicide or anything like that
just
to the rain. So yeah. I didn't do anything like that, but I really thought it was important to write about rain as inspiration and rain as mood generator in art, which it, you know, clearly is in film, music, painting, and so on. But the one artist for which cognitive psychologists actually have tried to directly analyze the impact of rain on her work was Emily Dickinson, yeah. As you mentioned. She really didn't like rain. I read a lot of her letters that talked about the weather and how miserable rain was. And, literary critics had already noted that Dickinson cranked out a lot more poetry in spring and summer than she did in autumn and winter. But the really fascinating study I found was from a pair of cognitive psychologists who asked the question, what was the quality of the poetry that she wrote in these different seasons? And they found, and they decided to determine this by looking at the poetry that had been collected in anthologies or that had won awards. And they found that when they looked at her best poetry, a considerably higher percentage of her best poems had been written in autumn and winter, even though she wrote more poems in spring and summer. So they concluded that those dark days really provided her with material that she could use and inspiration. Maybe not the positive inspiration that some of us think of, but a different sort of dark inspiration.
I don't suppose you have the storm there in front of you, do you?
I do have the storm.
Do you mind?
In front of me, absolutely. I'll read this. This poem, "The Storm," will give you a taste of the gloom in Dickinson's mind when it came to especially thunder and lightning. Yeah. "There came a wind like a bugle. It quivered through the grass, and a green chill upon the heat so ominous did pass. We barred the windows and the doors as from an emerald ghost, the doom's electric moccasin that very instant passed."
That's a good one.
I love the Doom's electric moccasins.
Yeah, I do too.
Just fabulous.
Let's come back to how rain may have influenced human evolution. You talked to this neurobiologist to help you explain, I loved this part, how our fingers get wrinkly when it's wet, which he describes as an evolutionary adaptation, that it was providing traction for us because our early ancestors were really deluged. At least this was
they
one of the...
They were. So the earliest... human ancestors lived in what scientists called pluvial time. So at different times in history, we see, great dry periods, and we see pluvial times where it's really, really rainy for hundreds or even thousands of years. So we evolved in such soggy times from the rainforests of East Africa. And I think it's so neat that these times predate human memory, but yet we can look at our fingers and see those times. So if you look at your finger wrinkles after you've been having a long soak in the bath, this happens on both our fingers and our toes. Popular belief long held that the pruny effect is just some sort of osmosis. But a neurobiologist named Mark Changizi figured out that this pruniness comes from the autonomic nervous system, which is a largely involuntary control panel in the lower brainstem that also prompts breathing and swallowing and other basics. And other primates get the finger wrinkles too. So that automatic physical trigger to water suggests that this is an evolutionary adaptation. So Dr. Cheng Yizi says primates would not have had to evolve to deal with porcelain bathtubs,
right.
But they would have had to adapt to rain. And his research shows that our finger wrinkles are essentially rain treads. And he's shown that your smooth fingers grip best when it's dry. But if it's really wet, wrinkly fingers help us grip much better. So, and they also form very quickly so that they could gear up. They form to gear up to rainy conditions, but you never get them just from, you know, from eating fruit or washing your hands. You get them when it's really quite wet. And all of these are clues to an ancient adaptation for gripping in the rainy forests where ancestors lived some 10 million years ago. It's just amazing.
You mentioned earlier how it was actually after the rain finally started to taper off that we evolved to be the hominids we are today, you know, upright hunters and gatherers. And this was interesting that there may be a connection between the age of agriculture and the lack of rain. That is us adapting to, I guess, drought.
That's right. That's right. So we were in rainier times. We were hunter gatherers. We could find plenty of stuff out there to eat, and it was during one of those periods of great aridity that anthropologists say people began to gather in civilizations, and they're you know all four great early civilizations in Mesopotamia, the Indus Valley, in Egypt, and along the Yellow River. These all came about during times of great aridity when anthropologists theorize that humans had to come together and settle near rivers and work together on irrigating food to feed each other. It was no longer enough to be able to be alone and forage. And so, but the really interesting thing to me about that story is that all four civilizations also collapsed in the epic droughts of 4,000 years ago, which were spread all over the world. So it's really interesting that rain or lack of rain might have led to the great civilizations coming together in the first place, but also their collapse. Mm.
When we get back from the break, I want to talk about religion and rain, the idea of praying for rain or burning witches because of rain. Before we do, I want to play, as we head into this break, I want to play some Chopin. Would you tell us the story behind the Raindrop Prelude?
So Chopin was holed up in a Majorcan monastery in a great rainstorm, and he was composing, and his lover described coming across him composing at the piano and being in tears. And this is one of the, you know, one of the great piano works came out of this storm.
Cynthia Barnett is with us. Her book is called Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Cynthia Barnett. We're talking about her book, Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. We talked about that central theme that's running through the book about control. Every culture convinced itself it could master the rain. And one of the ways it tried anyway was through prayer. There's a great Texan, Robert McAlpin Williamson, a popular judge and a preacher, who gave a kind of powerful, beautiful prayer for rain. Talk about him as a character.
Yeah, so I start the, well, I should back up for a moment and say that every culture has always prayed for rain. Humans have always prayed for rain. The very first known god, a god from Mesopotamia, from the Sumerians, was a god of rain and storms. And so this is a very common part of the human experience. And so we sort of make fun of Christian governors these days for praying for rain, but I think it's what we've always done. And I think, you know, brides pray for it not to rain right on their wedding day, and farmers pray for rain. A country music composer just sent me his song about the same day in Kansas where the farmer is praying for rain and the bride is praying for it not to rain.
Yeah.
But anyway, I start the rain prayer chapter with a judge, as you mentioned. His name was Robert McAlpin Williamson. He was known by the nickname Three-Legged Willie. And part of his job, in addition to being a judge and a lay preacher, when it came time to pray for rain in Texas, he would pray for rain. And if you want me to, I can read you his typical prayer.
Yeah, I love this one. It's really nice, I think, you know?
Yeah, it's nice. Oh, Lord, thou divine Father, the supreme ruler of the universe, who holdest the thunder and lightning in thy hands, and from the clouds givest rain to make crops for thy children, look down with pity upon thy children who now face ruin for the lack of rain upon their crops. And, O Lord, send us a bounteous rain that cause the crops to fruit in all their glory and the earth to turn again to that beauteous green that comes with abundant showers. Lord, send us a bounteous one that will make corn ears shake hands across the row, and not one of those drizzly rains that will make nubbins that all hell can't shuck.
It's great.
Corn ears shake hands across the row.
That's a nice image.
Row. It's very nice.
Well, you mentioned, you know, the earliest gods that humans worshipped were gods of, you know, storms and rain. You mentioned the Sumerians, of course, and you write about the Aztecs, who believed
The Aztecs believed that lots of little small gods lived in the hills and mountains and acted as helpers to the great rain god Tlaloc, which is the god you think of when you see the South American statue of a rain god. But they really believed in these little guys who were his helpers, and scientists now tell us that they've got proof of Aztecs sacrificing very, very small children to the rain gods. And this was a time, you know, another of those times of extreme epic drought.
Yeah.
The molecular anthropologists have found graves with little infant skeletons, and they've analyzed the victims' DNA and found that most of them were younger than three and most of them were male. And their theory is that the Aztecs had tried to please these little rain gods by finding the closest likenesses they could find when they did their human sacrifices.
You mentioned in the book, we don't have time to get to all of this, but, you know, many cultures came to see hard rain as male and soft rain as female. It's interesting how some cultures make the kind of sexual metaphor kind of literal, this idea of rain like semen, frankly.
Yeah.
These Judeo-Christian stories are interesting. I did want to ask you about that, how rain often plays a part in the sense that God uses rain and drought in, you know, like Judeo-Christian cultures to control the chosen people.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And just to answer your question about religions and cultures and how they viewed rain as gendered, when the Hebrew God was creating earth, he divided the waters in the heavens above from those on land below, and Jewish tradition identifies the upper waters, the rainfall, as male, and the lower lakes, rivers, and springs as female, citing the line in Isaiah, "Let the earth open to receive, that it may bear the fruit of salvation." Mm. And you see this in other religions too. In Sanskrit, the word for rain, varsha, is derived from a word that means not only rain but also having manly power. But you're right. One interesting thing about looking at the influence of rain and religion was to see how monotheism evolved from some of the harshest, dry places of the world.
Yeah.
And that many of the polytheistic religions, you know, evolved from parts of the world that were, you know, deluged by monsoons. And some scholars speculate that in different climates, people evolved very different belief systems for looking at nature and its influence on their lives.
This idea of religion and rain really plugs into your central theme about this idea of binding people together in unity.
Yes.
You write about the flood, for example, the story of the Great Flood. It comes up a few times, in fact, in the book. And it seems to me one of the things that this flood, you know, the Great Deluge, is about is in Gilgamesh and in the Old Testament and all kinds of cultures, is this idea about rain unifying humanity. Because you've and I wanted you to talk about that, because you've said that you think in some ways the idea of using faith as one of those ways to change our ethic about water. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, and you know, literally, I literally go talk about water in churches. There's a great interest in sustainability in many places of worship, and a lot of interest in the idea in the water ethic. And in fact, I think churches and places of worship are really important for the water conversation. You know, getting beyond rain for a moment to the water pressure that you're under in the American West. Yeah. I think churches may be able to help in places where the government and the political system and the engineering answers have let us down. You know, a lot of these issues come down to ethics and morals, which are sometimes better to talk about in a place of worship than in a, you know, state house, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But I really like the flood story for all the reasons you say. It is a story of survival and ingenuity, and there's wisdom in the flood story, and there's also a lesson of heeding the forewarning from the skies, right? Noah listened. Mm-hmm. Noah listened to the forewarnings. He and the other ark-building heroes and all of those stories, I think, have something to tell us about coming together. And it's what we've always done. It's what we've done for thousands of years, whether the story was too much rain or too little. So I really get frustrated when people say, oh, you know, the climate has always changed. Mm-hmm. Climate has changed. We know it's changed for far longer than humans existed on the Earth. So there's no evidence that humans are causing climate change today. In fact, our past climate swings, to me, give us all the more reason why we would come together and try to overcome our differences and confront this serious threat that we have with our human ingenuity instead of ignoring all the signs around us.
You mention in the book, you come around to this idea of the effect of climate change on rain, on weather patterns. You mention how scientists can't really tie any particular flood or any particular drought to climate change, but that they are detecting a pretty broad change in the increasing number of extreme weather events, extreme rainfall, for example.
Yeah, so that's something that is not so uncertain. You know, so it's hard, sometimes hard to talk about angles of climate change because there's a lot of uncertainty. But one thing they have more certainty about is the fact that when it rains, climate change is creating more severe or more heavier precipitation. Right. So here in the United States, for example, when it rains, the rain is coming in heavier downpours than it did in earlier history. So over the past 50 years especially, heavy precipitation events have really increased. And that's true not only where I am in the southeastern United States, but where you are. And in Utah, downpours are about 21% more intense than they were 50 years ago. And we've certainly seen some epic flooding in the past few years, such as the floods of Boulder, Colorado. Right. The Northeast has especially been prone to these heavier downpours. In the northeastern United States, the downpours have increased 74% over 50 years ago. But this trend is being seen all over the world. So when it rains, rains are becoming more intense. And when drought happens, the dry times too are getting drier. And this makes absolute sense from the standpoint of physics, right? Higher temperatures cause greater evaporation and therefore more rain, right, where water exists, and they make it hotter and drier where water is already scarce.
It comes back to that idea we were talking about early on about water vapor being a greenhouse gas. And you mentioned in the book the question of just how much more water vapor will fill the atmosphere in the future and what the consequences will be are both unsettled and unsettling.
Yes, that's right. So you remember from the early days of Earth that water vapor is a strong greenhouse gas. It's more potent than carbon dioxide or any other. And so water vapor's natural warming has helped keep Earth in this Goldilocks spot, which is what astrobiologists call it. Remember, we talked about Venus and Mars lost their water. Earth is in this perfect Goldilocks spot for hanging on to it, for having an ideal atmosphere for life. So the question is, as the world consumes more fossil fuels and temperatures continue to rise, what will the increase of water vapor in the atmosphere do? Scientists say it could double the greenhouse effect caused by carbon dioxide alone. So some scientists, such as James Hansen, the retired head of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, believes this hike in water vapor could ultimately cause a runaway greenhouse, and that is what happened to the rains and oceans of Venus. Other climate scientists say that is too much of an apocalyptic notion. But we will be here for the storms. We will see the increased rainfall, the more extreme storms, and we're seeing already more extreme drought. You know, the 15-year drought along the Colorado River being one example. Scientists are now raising the specter of mega drought, those sorts of droughts we were talking about earlier that led to the demise of the Mesopotamian culture, the Indus River culture, the Egyptian not culture, but civilizations, the Egyptian civilization and the early Yellow River civilization.
So we got about a minute left, and I wanted to switch gears a little bit and have you talk about the scent of rain, finally. Again, one of my favorite parts in the book, I have to say, that the scent of rain is about the compounds in the air. So talk a little bit about the scent of rain.
This is also one of my favorite parts of the book. It does have to do with the compounds in the air, the oils from plants that gather on the earth and then are released when a rain falls. But what's so interesting to me about the scent of rain is that it really depends on where you are in the world. So where you are, you may smell a scent of sage, and where I am in the south, I smell a wonderful scent of pine and wet moss. And people in India have a wonderful, earthy, strong memory of the scent of rain. And I actually traveled to an Indian village where villagers, fragrance makers, know how to capture the scent of earth before the monsoon rains, to capture that incredible, heady scent of rain. And it's just the scent of rain is so powerful. It's another part of rain that binds us together, and it really gives us a strong memory of rain from childhood. And place, you know, as Terry Tempest Williams says, place is so important. And where you come from really does help define your scent of rain and your memory of the scent of rain.
Cynthia Barnett, environmental journalist. Her book is Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. She joined us from a radio station WUFT in Gainesville, Florida. Cynthia Barnett, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Daniel Lombardi and Braden Child. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The show is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
Against my window, bringing back sweet memories. Hey, when the rain, do you remember? How sweet it is.